You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso and espresso and cream flavors. I had one this morning before I came into the studio, and let me tell you, it gave me just the boost I needed to get my day going. Plus, it tastes so delicious, I'd drink it anyway. So close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Author Brad Meltzer is well known for his best-selling thrillers like The Escape Artist, The Inner Circle, The Book of Fate, and 9 other bestsellers, all fictional tales of secret societies and vast conspiracies within the halls of power, with just enough factual and historical background to give his books the unsettling ring of truth. But it's taken 20 years for Brad Meltzer to uncover a true story in American history with all the political intrigue and deadly high stakes of one of his novels. He writes about it in his latest book, The First Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill George Washington. And today, Brad joins me on the podcast to talk about the risks of diving into his first work of nonfiction, all the research that went into it, and his initial concerns that a long-forgotten rumor of a secret plot to assassinate America's founding father might turn out to be just that, a rumor. He tells the story of America's other Benedict Arnold and the deadly conspiracy by some of the very men charged with protecting George Washington's life during the most critical few days of the American Revolution. He reveals how the incident gave birth to American counterintelligence, why Washington wasted no time in making an example of one of the conspirators, and why there was a deliberate effort to cover up the plot to kill Washington for more than 240 years. Plus, he shares some of the wild conspiracy theories he hears from his fans at book signings, his alarm over the explosion of conspiracy thinking and paranoia in American politics, and a few memories of his friend, the late President George H.W. Bush. Coming up with number one best-selling author Brad Meltzer in just a minute. Brad Meltzer is the number one New York Times best-selling author of The Escape Artist, The Inner Circle, and many other best-selling thrillers, as well as the Ordinary People Change the World series for young people. He's also the host of the History Channel TV shows Brad Meltzer's Decoded and Brad Meltzer's Lost History. Now he collaborates with his Lost History producer and writer Josh Mensch on his first nonfiction book titled The First Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill George Washington. Brad Meltzer, welcome to the podcast.
I appreciate you having me.
Well, Brad, it turns out that you and I have a couple of mutual friends, Randy and Jason Sklar.
I saw, they warned me that before here. Randy and Jason didn't, but my editor did, which is, you've just said magical passwords because, you know, I only know them since I'm 19 years old.
Yeah. Didn't y'all go to college together?
We did. Right? We were all in college. And now, are you from St. Louis?
No. I just know them from L.A. I got to know them at a few of their shows. They came on my podcast, and we kind of became friends, and they actually just officiated my wedding 2 months ago. So.
Oh, fantastic. No, I literally was at their weddings. They are two of my oldest friends on the whole planet. In fact, when I go and do a book event in St. Louis, their mom, their mom out to dinner, and she'll be like, you know, my own mom passed away, and so she's like my adopted mom when I'm in St. Louis, and she's like, just, you know, every person that walks by the table, from the waiter to the person pouring drinks, she's like, he's an author, you should buy his books. So that always, their mom always has a special place in my heart.
I love it. She's the perfect Jewish mom.
Oh, Annette Sklar knows, has many powers.
What were they like in college?
Same. No one's different. Let's be honest. I mean, in fact, my first comedy bit that I ever did is I was in a talent show. I was a senior. They were sophomores. And the talent was, it had three rounds to win the talent, to win this kind of like a beauty pageant. And the first round was you had to dress up as your hero. And I knew I had a great hero. I was going to go, and this was 25 years ago, I was going to go as Spider-Man. And I dressed up as Spider-Man. And Randy and Jason Sklar, their father sold industrial Velcro. And so he gave us for free an entire like ream of it. And I had a tailor sew it into a red suit. And then we built a wall, and I got a trampoline, and I jumped off the trampoline. And like David Letterman's old trick, I stuck to the wall. And I knew that it was going to be a crowd pleaser because I was sticking to a wall. And then if you made past that round, it narrowed down to 10 people who – it was the talent portion. And the talent portion was you had to have a talent. And this was my problem, is I had no talent. And so Randy and Jason wrote me a comedy bit, literally a puppet show with sock puppets. And I performed it. And then I had to make – if you made it past that round, you got to the final five. You had to answer a question live on stage. And I actually wound up winning the whole thing. But it was thanks to them when I was 21 years old.
Wow. Well, you may have been their first gig as comedy writers.
No, they were doing comedy themselves, but I was the first one that they were writing for, I think.
Yeah. Now, had you done comedy before that or
no,
since?
No, I knew
you
nothing.
You said that was your first experience.
They literally taught me everything. Yeah, they literally taught me everything I knew about comedy in those, you know, week or 3 hours of practice that I put in.
Were you both on the pre-law track back then? Because I know they were going to become lawyers originally too, right?
Yeah, my start, you know, I was, I went to University of Michigan for undergrad and went to a job. There was a guy in Boston who wanted to take me under his wing. He was a lawyer, but he was also a business person. And he said, you know what, don't go to law school. Come work for me. If you love it, you'll stay. If you hate it, you'll leave with some money in your pocket. And I thought that was a good deal. So I moved all my stuff to Boston, moved everything to Boston. And the week I got to Boston, he left the job. And I thought, oh, crap. I was like, I can't, what do I mean, I was like, I wrecked my life. I've wrecked it. That's it. And so I did what all of us do in situations where we think we wrecked our lives. I said, I'm going to write a novel. And it seemed logical at the time. I felt like everyone had one story in them. I should take a shot. I wrote my first novel. It got me 24 rejection letters. There were only 20 publishers at the time. I got 24 rejection letters. You know, some people were writing me twice to make sure I got the point.
What did they say to you?
They just, you know, it was a form rejection, you know. Some said they liked it, but it was, you know, they were just rejection after rejection. But I was young. I was 24 years old. And I said, if they don't like that book, I'm going to write another. And if they don't like that book, I'm going to write another. And the week after I got my 23rd and 24th rejection letter, I started the book that became my first published novel. It was called The Tenth Justice. And at that point, I was in law school. I sold the book while I was in law school. And luckily, someone actually bought it.
Yeah, and what a book to kick it off with. I mean, coming out of law school, I could have easily seen you following in John Grisham's path, writing legal thrillers, but you were drawn to this, well, I guess what was kind of a new genre at the time, political thrillers, and specifically ones that usually involve some kind of deep state conspirators operating in the background. It's a genre that you practically invented. How did you decide that the political thriller was where you wanted to plant your literary flag?
Yeah, no, you know, it's so funny. I mean, I don't think we invented much of anything. I operated under one assumption, which was this, is I am not that special. And if I like it, and I found it interesting that there hopefully would be other people out there, one or two, who would find it equally interesting. And that's all I've operated on. I mean, you know, It's like the old Mark Twain story, and I'll horribly paraphrasing here, but Mark Twain supposedly said, you know, a fine literary novel is like a fine glass of wine, but my books are like water, but everybody drinks water. And that was what I had to offer is I really liked knowing where the secret tunnels are below the White House. I really liked knowing where the hidden labyrinth is below the U.S. Capitol. And when I wanted to write one about the financial world, I wrote one about the financial world. And I didn't go like, I'm going to invent something different. I wanted to be John Grisham when I started. I was a kid and he was writing The Firm, and that was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. But the universe that I just kept operating in, I just kept finding these nuggets and these details of real history that just made me go, you know what, let's write about that. So when I found out that, you know, about some congressional staffers who were gambling on Congress, I was like, that's a really cool idea. Let's see if I can turn that into a novel. Or when I found, you know, something about the president's daughter, and I thought, that's a really fascinating world. Let me write about that. Or when I found about the Freemasons and a secret code that Thomas Jefferson had used when he was president, I was like, huh, I wonder if I can turn that, and it became the Book of Fate. So even with the escape artist, you know, I went on a USO tour and found the men and women that take right. care of our fallen soldiers and take care of their bodies and lay them to rest, rebuilding their hands so that their mother, when she specifically says, I want to hold my son's hand one last time, that she can hold her son's hand one last time. I just was blown away by that and said, you know what, I need to write a book about that. So all I followed all these years is just my own gut instinct of what I like. And you know, thank God people have followed me along.
Now, when an author goes on a USO tour, what is that like? You don't strut out there in a bikini or something.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean,
like
if you really want
to,
you know,
how
really
do you do that?
Cheer. Yeah, no, well, the funny thing is so the USO for many years, now that I think they do it every other year, but they used to do every year they would bring six thriller writers to the to the Middle East to entertain the troops. And the best part was on the year that I went, I think I went on the third tour they ever did, and it was right after the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders had been there and the MMA fighters. And my buddy was like, can you tape the audible sigh when you walk in the room? And they realize that after the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, they're like, oh my gosh, great. I got, who's this? Oh, it's the literate authors. How wonderful. You know, but we loved it. And I loved doing it. And the best part of it was, yeah. I've actually done it a number of times for them. I've gone to the Middle East. I've gone to Cuba. The best part of doing it is listen, it's not like when the country singers come to town and there's, you know, thousands upon thousands of people in a mash pot, you know, like a massive concert that you think of Bob Hope. But what we always have is you have these crowds that come up to us, and there'll be people that come out of it and they'll say, you know, I just want you to know, Brad, you're the first person that's ever come on a USO tour that I feel like is here for me. I'm a reader. And I know, you know, in that moment you found your people, and those people are out there too serving. And there are amazing men and women out there that just inspired me. And that's why the last thriller I wrote was about, as I said, the men and women who work in the mortuaries that take care of our fallen troops when they come back from combat. I just was like, wait, you're telling me there's a secret mortuary where the victims of 9/11 went, where the victims of the Challenger explosion went, where you know, some of the biggest disasters, where all of our secret spies across the globe, when their bodies, they all go back to Dover, Delaware, to a secret mortuary? I was like, this is a place that's filled with secrets. I need to write about this. And The Escape Artist was the book that came out of it.
As an author who writes about these high-level secrets and conspiracies, when you go on a USO tour or a book tour and you talk to fans, do you encounter a lot of conspiracy theorists?
Oh, no one gets crazier email. I mean, listen, I hosted a show called Brad Meltzer's Decoded, right?
Yeah.
And Decoded, if you had a crazy story, you either call Jesse Ventura or you call me. So I had the family of John Wilkes Booth, and of course John Wilkes Booth shot Abraham Lincoln. 12 days after Lincoln was shot, John Wilkes Booth himself was killed, according to every history book you'll read. And the family of John Wilkes Booth, through their lawyer, a friend of mine, reached out and said, "Hey, I represent John Wilkes Booth's family. They have a story they want to tell you." He actually didn't die. 12 days later, they got the wrong guy. Their relative escaped. And he went on the run, and he changed his name, took on a new identity, and they have the proof. Would you like to hear their story?
Wow.
Yes, I want to hear that story, right? Like, I want to hear that story. And so people tell me, you know, people come to my book signings and they bring me the crazy, they brought me the Holy Grail. I have, you know, so if you need the regenerative powers of the Holy Grail, it's in the Barnes and Noble in Los Angeles. It's right between Meltzer and Melville on the shelf alphabetically. But people bring me and tell me the craziest stories, of course. So we get, you know, conspiracy people, but we also get, you know, people approach me because they know that, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't go out there and say, you know, the government's trying to kill you in the middle of the night. I listen to the story. We find the evidence. I'm a history major. That's what my degree is in. And you have to have the proof. And to me, sometimes there's proof and you can say, you know, there's a problem here. And sometimes you look and say, this is just made up crap on the internet. And for me, I love being able to tell people the difference between those two things.
And of course, you wrote a little bit about the magician Harry Houdini in your last book. And I always heard that he was, of course, good friends with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle would never believe that it was just all a trick. He believed that he was pretending that it was just a trick, but it was really, he had some magical powers. And I almost wonder if you get people who come up to you at these book signings who do something similar where they say, okay, all this stuff that you talked about in any of these books, that really happened, right? You're just saying that it's fiction because you have to, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, listen, I years ago, I got a call from the Department of Homeland Security asking me to come in and brainstorm different ways that terrorists could attack the United States. And my first thought was, if they're calling me, we have bigger problems than anybody thinks, right? Like, if you think we're screwed now, just wait. And I was honored to do it. I love doing it. But as a result, when that story came out, everyone was like, oh, you're hiding your fiction and things. And the thing that I was struck by is, why me? Why'd they pick me of all people? They could pick anyone. And I traced it back through history. I traced back to a man named George Washington. And as I'm sure you know, George Washington had his own secret spy ring made up of regular, ordinary people, the Culper Ring. And he picked regular, ordinary people because he knew everyone on the British side, they knew who his top military advisors were. But if he used regular, ordinary people, Washington knew one thing. No one looks twice at an ordinary person. And I said to my friend in Homeland Security, wouldn't it be cool if I wrote a fictional thriller and you found out that George Washington's spy ring still existed to this very day? And he said to me, what makes you think it doesn't? And I was like, that's a good idea for a book. So I wrote a fictional thriller, The Inner Circle, based on that exact thing where someone finds out that George Washington's spy ring exists to this very day. And it was all fiction. And when I was researching the sequel to that, I went to one of these top people at the CIA. I'm talking about one of the big names, big acronym titles. And I said to him, I'm doing a follow-up on my thriller. It's a sequel. It's about George Washington's spy ring still existing today. And he says to me, I'm not joking, he says, oh, yeah, I heard they're still around. And I was like, what are you talking about? I made that up. And then and that's the crazier part. It's not just people coming and assuming your fiction is real, but where you think your fiction is real and people are telling you it's not. You know, obviously that to me is the most fun part of the job is, you know, fiction is a big giant lie and it's just trying to masquerade as the truth. That's all fiction is. And the more I can kind of fill these books with real truths, you'll believe it. And I think it's probably going to do me no favors to the crazy people who will come calling when we finally put out this nonfiction book that we're doing.
And the lines seem like they're even more blurred these days. You know, as someone who's made his name writing about fictional conspiracies, does it trouble you that we now have people like Alex Jones who essentially do the same thing, crafting conspiracies out of whole cloth, but trying to pass off fiction as fact?
You know, I always say that our greatest strength is our greatest weakness. It always will be. It always has been. And the beautiful part of the internet today, you know, it used to be, you couldn't get anyone to read your thing if it wasn't in a newspaper, and you couldn't get into the newspaper if the editors didn't sound off about it and the reporter didn't report on it. And so the great part of the internet today is we all have a printing press, so to speak. We have it in our pocket. It's, you know, we have it on Twitter and Facebook. We can all publish whatever we want. We're walking founts of our own, you know, newspapers with our own names on them. And that's a beautiful thing. It gives every one of us power that we never had before. It's our greatest strength right now is every voice can be heard. It's also, of course, our greatest weakness. It's a disaster because every voice can be heard and we don't even know what's true anymore. The number one thing that the American people want right now is the truth. And we can't find it. Go put the word Freemason into Google. Go put the word Russia into Google. It'll take you 10 pages before you can get past and find an actual shred of truth anywhere. And that's a disaster. I mean, if you go and put 9/11, the Pentagon crash, on YouTube, and you're trying to find the real footage, it will take you, I can't tell you how long before you can find actual news footage. All you'll find instead is crazy conspiracy theories telling you all the things that didn't happen and did happen and things you didn't know, you know, that are just all totally made up. And I think, you know, it's a danger, right? It is. There was just a recent study done looking into the future of you know, how you can just take out an entire culture if we can't distinguish truth from fiction anymore. But I do feel a responsibility to really make sure that what you're putting out there is right. It's why we've got something like 75 pages of footnotes in this book, is to make sure people know, you know, you can't just make this crap up and just go out and sell it. You got to really do your homework. And I think truth just has a very different value than it ever used to.
Yeah, and maybe some of it is wishful thinking because, you know, having watched just the utter chaos and the lack of discipline and direction from the White House over the past 2 years, I'll tell you, sometimes it makes me wish there was a deep state, you know, or some
right,
kind of
no,
guiding
right.
hand
I mean,
behind the scenes.
Well, that's the thing is you feel like, you know, we're arguing. It's one thing. Everyone has an opinion, and it's okay, right? And we can all interpret
right.
certain things in different ways. We can experience the same exact situation and come away with two different feelings from it. That to me is an okay thing. But I feel like sometimes we're arguing about like gravity. You know, I mean, we know Russia tried to infiltrate the United States. We know that it happened. They've even said as much. I mean, they don't even deny it anymore. And we're not even attacking that. We fired the guy in charge of that at the White House who's in charge of cybercrime. Like, this should be no argument. And the thing that I'm actually thankful for is lately we're actually seeing Democrats and Republicans. You saw it recently with the Saudi Arabia story with Khashoggi, is that people are like, you know what? We have to stand for something. Democrats and Republicans are finally going like, you know what? If we don't have a soul as a country, we have nothing. And so I do have hope that, you know, maybe, and again, this is wishful thinking, but maybe just maybe when you lose as much of the truth as we have been losing, it's been kind of whittled away, that the backlash goes the other way and you have a giant, great demand for it. So time will tell, but it is what is so frustrating watching the world today because you're watching things and going, I can't even believe that people are believing this side of it. And, you know, I just did an event. I just was at President Bush's funeral, because he was a friend of ours. I had done a lot of work with him for literacy. No politics about it. Just, you know, we did a lot. President Bush and Mrs. Bush did a lot of work for family literacy over the years, where they bring Democrats and Republicans to Kennebunkport, Maine, and raise money for people who can't read. You know, one of the great causes out there. And the one thing that you can see with the Bushes and the one thing you can see it is so desperately needed with his, you know, when his death happened, is this kind of outpouring of one word that kept coming over and over in everyone that spoke about him, which was the word decency.
Yeah.
And to me, I think the reason you heard the word decency so much is we're starving for that too. We're just not seeing it anymore. We can't disagree with anyone. We have to hate someone who doesn't see the way we do. And one of the things I used to talk about with, you know, I knew from President Bush, and I just did an event with President Clinton when his Thriller just came out. As I asked him flat out, I said, if you watch MSNBC and someone else watches Fox only, each of you watches only one of them, you have absolutely opposing views of what's happening in the world right now. I mean, one of you is totally pissed and one of you is totally fine. And if we are as a culture living two different realities, how do we ever break that barrier? And the true answer is we won't unless someone steps forward or unless, you know, there's someone new in the White House who can kind of cross lines. But as long as we have these diametrically opposed views, we're going to get nowhere. And I encourage anyone listening to this, again, whatever your politics are, listen to something on the opposing side. It'll frustrate the crap out of you. You want to bang your head against the wall. But if you don't, you're living in an echo chamber and you're doing yourself no favors. But go see how the other world sees it. Because the one thing I know for sure is that every person you hate politically and every person you think is so stupid and they're so dumb, because that's what we do with all of anyone that disagrees with us today. We just, you know, we unfollow them and we say they're stupid and dumb. But those people have hopes and dreams just like you. And you have to take a moment and say, what are they upset about? And listen, I'm not talking about the pure racists out there, like or the Nazis that are out. I mean, you know, there are people that just absolutely they're wrong. They're just wrong, sure. And some things need to be right and wrong. But the average person who's watching these shows, the average American who's sitting there in the middle, who's not doing it out of some racist thing or because they want to hurt someone, the average person, just wants the same things you want in your life, and that is to love and be loved, to have security, to have a good family. And there's something out there that is threatening them. If you take a little time and try and understand that, I think it's the only way. It's like the old Gandhi lesson, the only way to change the world, you got to start with yourself.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Brad Meltzer when we come back in just a minute. Did you know that 43% of college graduates are underemployed, working jobs that don't even require a college degree? Imagine if one of the most significant investments of your life, your college degree, only worked half the time. A refund is the least you'd expect. With courses in software engineering, data science, and UX/UI design, Flatiron School stands behind its students with a tuition money-back guarantee. Flatiron offers graduates a career services program with career coaches and ongoing learning. Students who follow every step of the plan and don't get a qualifying tech job offer within 6 months of graduating are eligible for a full tuition refund. See the complete details at flatironschool.com/terms. With graduates at hundreds of leading tech companies, the Flatiron School program is working. Full and part-time programs are available online and at Flatiron School campuses around the world. Join the school that's reinventing education, starting with student outcomes. Learn more at flatironschool.com/kickass. Again, that's flatironschool.com/kickass. In today's age, it can be hard to find the time to sit down and learn, especially when the likes of social media can be so addictive and time-consuming. So you may think that you don't have the time to read a book or to develop yourself. Well, think again. Blinkist is the only app that condenses thousands of nonfiction books into the best key takeaways and need-to-know information, so you can read or listen to them in just 15 minutes. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library from self-help, business, and health to history books. I read a lot of books for interviews on this podcast, and that takes up a large part of my day. But with Blinkist, I can get the most important points of a book, which prepares me for my interviews in less time, and really makes me a more intelligent, informed, and healthy me. Plus, I'm an auditory learner, so being able to listen with Blinkist suits me perfectly. They have a long list of books available. I used Blinkist to reacquaint myself with a real classic over the holidays, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. And then I listened to the number one bestseller, Fire and Fury, Inside the Trump White House by Michael Wolff. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for my audience. Go to Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. One more time, that's Blinkist.com/kick. And now, back to the podcast. I was going to ask you about George H.W. Bush because I knew that you had this friendship with him. He's exactly the kind of person who might figure into one of your novels, it seems. You know, a member of Skull and Bones, former CIA director, who was always either in the background or the foreground of every major event. Do you wish that you could have gotten in his head and known everything that he knew?
Yeah, I mean, of course I did. And every time I would be with him, I would pump him for information in different stories. In fact, you know, one of the times when I was asking him about exactly that, I was like, you know, I'd heard the story of that Ronald Reagan had secretly left a hidden letter in the Oval Office desk for President Bush, and that Bush then left a secret letter for Clinton, and Clinton left one for W, who left one for Obama, so on and so forth. And I just said to him, you know, could you pass secret notes in those letters to each other? Is it possible? Huh. And this was years ago. I opened my email one day, and it's from one of his staffers, and it says, the president wants you to have this. And I was like, what's this? And I look at the attachment, and he had sent to me, if you've seen it in the last election or even when he died floating around the internet, it's because he released to me for the very first time the secret letter that he wrote and left in the Oval Office desk for Bill Clinton.
Wow.
And I don't know why he gave it to me. To this day, I don't know why he gave it to me, why he gave it to a fiction writer. but he gave that letter to me, and he obviously experienced these. I mean, and when I got the letter, I was like, oh my gosh, I checked it for secret. I'm like, he sent me a secret code. I checked it, you know, to see if it had Freemason codes. I checked it, you know, UV light. I checked to see if the first letter of every word spelled out, I hate you, Bill. I was like, you know, what is in this letter? Because at that moment, you know, Clinton has just beat him, made him a one-term president. He has every reason to hate Bill Clinton. And in that moment, President Bush, you know, the letter's on my website or you can find it on the internet, but it just says, I'm rooting for you, man. Your success is our country's success, and I'm just cheering for you. And it's the most humble, gracious, wonderful, decent letter that you've ever seen. And again, it just shows how far we are from that moment right now.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's gone. I really do believe that, you know, this is hopefully a historical hiccup. And it's the reason why we wrote the new nonfiction book, The First Conspiracy, is, you know, it's not just a book about a secret plot to kill George Washington, which of course it is, but the fun of it is that it lets us look at those lessons that George Washington had that, you know, we like to think it was so easy and so wonderful and so perfect and he's the best leader, but he was betrayed by his own troops. They tried to kill him. Like, we have people trying to infiltrate our own government from the very first days of our own government. Like, this is an incredible story that is actually very important to where we are now and how we deal with foreign enemies and people who are trying to infiltrate us as a culture and as a country. And it happened back in 1776.
Now, your novels mix in a lot of history, and you, of course, have had your successful Ordinary People Change the World series for young people, but First Conspiracy is your first attempt at straight-up nonfiction that I'm aware of. Why is it taking you so long?
You know, I just think it was a matter of finding the right story. And the reality was is when I had a real story to tell, like that Abraham Lincoln one, and whether John Wilkes Booth truly escaped or took on another identity or really we got the wrong guy, I just would do it on television. And the reality was, is for those who liked Decoded or for those who followed the real history that we did there, we didn't have the show anymore. So I just said, you know what? I love this story. And I found it almost a decade ago in that great resting place where all great things can be found, in the footnotes of some book. I forget even what it was. But again, I saw the story of a secret plot to kill George Washington. I was like, is this real? Is it fake? Is it nonsense? What is it? And I went to, at the time, I went to Joseph Ellis, the Pulitzer Prize winning writer, who, of course, wrote one of the great George Washington biographies. And I said to him, is this true or is this like internet nonsense? And he said, no, I know the story. He didn't know much about it. He said, you know, you can find, you know, like we looked and there was no modern book written on the subject. And he said, here's the thing. He said, it's a story that involves George Washington and his own spies tracking down the people that were trying to kill him. And you can find every single, to the exact number, how many slaves George Washington owed, how many he owned. You can find the exact number of them. But you'll never, ever find every single one of George Washington's spies. He said to me at the time, so what you're searching for will forever be elusive. But he said, take a crack. At the very least, you're going to have a great story to tell. Maybe you'll get a book out of it. Maybe it'll just be an adventure. Maybe it'll lead you to nothing. And as you mentioned at the start, my friend Josh Mensch, who we did the Lost History TV show with, he's a documentarian, great historian, great writer. And it wound up just becoming this incredible adventure that showed us the real birthplace of the counterintelligence movement long before the word counterintelligence was ever invented. It was invented as a word in World War II. But the movement itself, civilians who were using their knowledge, not military people, but civilians, you know, to try and use intelligence techniques and intelligence gathering, that started in year one of these United States. And it happened and started with George Washington and this very secret committee on conspiracies that he found. So the first conspiracy was born right there.
And the head of this committee was John Jay, who most people know as the first Supreme Court justice. But would it be appropriate to credit him as America's first spy master?
Listen, I think George Washington's probably the first spy master. I'm giving credit, but he's certainly, I mean, he probably is the real one. Let's be honest. I mean, when not only did he stay in charge of that and then built another committee after they found out about this plot, what his best strength was at the time, even as a young man, was figuring out the bad guy's plans. As simple as that, to put it in the most simple of terms. He was really good at it. He was naturally good at it, like a cop. And he could just figure it out. And the reason we found out about the plot, as you'll see in the book, is just good old-fashioned police and detective and interrogation techniques. When they have some bad guy who has a story to tell and has a way to benefit if he tells it, they figure out what the hell is happening. And it's this amazing story. But it's John Jay. I mean, these guys were using amazing techniques back then. And you see that what this plot does is it gives us this entire new universe. We all like to think that the OSS was the precursor to the CIA.
Right.
But it was really John Jay's Committee on Conspiracies that was the precursor to all of it, and all of it owes a thank you to.
Yeah, in fact, don't they have a John Jay room at Langley?
They do. There's a special room at Langley at CIA headquarters that is named after John Jay, the father of counterintelligence. And it, you know, to this day, that room is still there, which I love. And you know, these are just these kind of lost moments to history that I was just like, we need to tell these stories. And I think in large part to what you said before, you know, we love to look at the around today and be like, oh my gosh, United States is in such a bad place. We all hate each other. It's so horrible. It's so terrible. But when you look, you know, we're a country that's founded on legends and myths. And the legend and myths we love the most are our own. So we love to think that we were, you know, in the Revolutionary War, we were this ragtag group and we just all came together and we fought the common enemy. And even though we didn't have shoes or bullets or gunpowder, we took on the greatest fighting force ever assembled. It's a great story. It's not a true story by any means. It sounds like a good story, but you know, even back then, at the start, we hated each other. The Connecticut regiments were different than the New Jersey regiments, were different than the Rhode Island regiments, the Massachusetts ones, and they would fight and argue. And you know, there's this great moment in the first conspiracy where the Virginians come to Harvard and meet the Massachusetts regiments. And the Massachusetts guys start making fun of the Virginians because they have these kind of frilly scarves that they wear in the uniform. No one's wearing the same uniform. They're all wearing different things, speaking with different accents. Everyone's different than each other. And this huge fight breaks out, and George Washington comes racing in on a horse and grabs two of the big guys responsible and just starts shaking them and throttling them for everyone to calm down. We hated each other. And it's only, and we deal with this part in the book, we're not some ragtag group that just takes everyone down because we held hands and all sang together. We get our butts kicked over and over and over. In one of the first big battles, the Battle of Brooklyn in New York, we get out-fought. We get out-generaled. George Washington has no experience compared to the generals, the British generals. And we're pinned against the East River. We're dead. It's over. We're done. And in that moment, George Washington do what many people would do is say, you know, I'm going to take out as many of them as I can. We're going to go out in a blaze of glory. But instead, George Washington does the best thing that George Washington always does, is he adapts. He says, you know what? We're not going to take out everyone in a blaze of glory. We're going to adapt and we're going to have a daring escape. And in the middle of the night, while everyone's sleeping, he brings all these boats to the East River, and one by one, all the men are getting on board and sailing and across the river. And what they all see is that George Washington won't get on the boat until all of them are on the boat. And he's putting others in front of himself, risking his own life for the lives of our men. And that's what leadership is, right? Like, that's the exact opposite of where we are as a culture today. We don't have leaders anymore. We have politicians. There's a huge difference between a leader and a politician.
Yeah.
And, you know,
see, I thought that he wouldn't get on the boat because he had lifeguards.
Right. Well, you know that, right? That, let's talk about
that.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, because this wasn't just a plot to assassinate George Washington. It was a plot from within.
Yeah. So, one of the great things we found, I never knew this part either until we started digging, is there was a point in time at the beginning of the Revolution where George Washington realizes he needs better guards. He needs so he asks all of his top, all the top regiments, he wants four men. He says, give me four men, your four best men you have. And those become, they call them, you know, the general's guards, they call them Washington's guards, the bodyguards. But what they really are called are his lifeguards. They truly are guarding his life. They are truly his lifeguards. And it's a number of these lifeguards who actually switch sides. And again, we love to tell the story of, you know, we're all this United States. We're all wonderful. We all come together. We fight the British. But it was far from that. There were so many people here who were still loyalists, still on the British side, who thought, you know what, the Patriots are gonna lose. Like, I should stick with the British side. And then when the Patriots did well, they were like, you know what, these British are gonna lose. We should switch. I mean, people were doing exactly what they are today. Where, sadly, they're opportunists, and there are people out there who will switch sides on a dime depending on who's winning. When George Washington says we don't have any more gunpowder, guess what? A lot of people are like, screw this. I don't want to be shot. I'm going to the other side. And when you have this this kind of flexibility, this moral flexibility in the people who are in your army, you better believe that there are people inside your army who can do a lot of harm. And that's what happens with the lifeguards. So it's the governor of New York starts plotting, the mayor of New York starts plotting, and they plot with members of George Washington's lifeguards. And you have these men who you trust. You have your closest of the close. And that's who betrays you? I don't care how strong you are. I don't care how powerful you are. I don't care how much of a quote-unquote man you are. You are devastated in that moment. And we get to chronicle in the first conspiracy those moments where George Washington realizes what's happening.
And the person who's at the center of this conspiracy, or at least the guy who took the fall for it, is a man named Thomas Hickey, who is one of these lifeguards. How come we know the name Benedict Arnold, but we don't know the name Thomas Hickey?
Yeah, the question we asked ourselves throughout the entire process. And we can guess why, but there's no one way to know. And I think it's this. Thomas Hickey was, as you said, the man who was hung. Who they even though he wasn't the man responsible for putting the plot in motion, it was the one who they made the example of. And he was one of George Washington's lifeguards who died and was hung in front of 20,000 onlookers. But the reason I think we don't know him is because his hanging took place on June 28th, 1776. We were literally like just about a week away from the Declaration of Independence being signed. The first drafts were being handed in right on that same day. The British were truly coming. And invading at that moment. And in the midst of all this chaos, at a moment when we're trying to portray nothing but strength, George Washington finds out that one of his own lifeguards has switched sides. I think the last thing you want to do in that moment, at least our theory is tell anyone that your own men have switched sides on you. It would be a complete sign of weakness, a complete sign. And I'm not talking about weakness from a macho sense of like, oh, you couldn't even keep your guards on your side, but just, you know, a sign of just how easy it was to do, that if you can get his, you know, the best drilled men, as he called them, then my God, everything was up for grabs. And I think that's the last thing you want to publicize that moment. So I think it just winds up getting lost in that, in the chaos and big stories of that moment. I kind of joke with my wife when she asked that same question. I said, the Declaration and the British invading was like the page A1 story. And the Hickey hanging was like, you know, C-13. And it just got buried. It got buried in all the other news of the day. It was like, you know, everything else on Twitter today. Like, there's big, huge things that just get lost.
Well, several of Washington's lifeguards were named as suspects in the conspiracy. So why was Hickey the one that they chose to make an example out of?
We'll never know the real answer to. Our theory is Hickey was an Irishman. And part of it may be that he was ethnic. And they felt like they could blame it on him. He wasn't, quote unquote, American enough. Although it's not really fair because another one also was someone who had a very heavy accent and had a kind of more ethnic name. But I honestly don't know. I don't know. I'm like, why didn't you hang the governor of New York? He's the guy who plotted the whole thing. Why didn't you hang the mayor of the New York? He was the one carrying the money and recruiting these guys one by one. Why didn't you hire the head of the lifeguards? He was the head. Part of it could simply just be that he was the one that everyone else pointed their fingers at, but he's the one who takes the blame. And I think as we record this on the day that Michael Cohen goes down and gets sentenced to his 3 years in prison, I think we can all understand that sometimes it's the lower guy that winds up taking the blame.
Now, one thing that's curious about all this is he was charged with mutiny, sedition, and corresponding with the enemy. But during the trial, there was no specific mention of a plot to either kidnap or kill George Washington. And even Washington himself makes no reference to this plot in his general orders or any of his personal correspondence
right,
that I'm aware
no
of.
Right, no letters, yeah.
Do you think that there was on some level a deliberate effort to conceal the nature of his crimes?
I mean, that's the only explanation we could come up with, because we and you see in the book, we dedicate an entire, you know, chapters to this. Like, why does Washington in all of his letters never say they were coming for me? Because if they were coming for me, I can tell you personally, I'd be telling everybody. The only thing that makes sense, and listen, if no one ever said it anywhere, then, you know, there's no story. The beautiful part of what we were able to find, as you see in the book, is we found the transcripts of the trial, and you find out what Hickey was doing. But the things that we're able to really point to were Washington's aide-de-camp and one of his top generals at the same exact time that the trial was happening. They were writing in their letters about that part of it. But one of the things that's really amazing when it happens is, you know, there can't be many, you know, it can't be 10 people that even know what's going on, but you see the people around Washington, they're all writing about it, and Washington isn't. And that's where you have to say why. And to me, the only reason, if you have your aide-de-camp, who's basically like, you know, your secretary, the body person who's literally with you wherever you go, and you have your top, one of your top military generals also writing about the exact same thing in the exact same way on the exact same day, and the president himself doesn't write about it, you have to believe, and this is what I took from it, is you just don't want that story out there. You don't, I mean, it's an embarrassment. Yeah. It's literally his top military guards. One, it's very Washington, right? He never really tells you his emotional state. He never tells you every single thing that happened. That's why he is such an enigma to us. He was always the quiet one. And you almost wish it happened to Adams, because you know you'd have like a book about it. But it is very Washington to do that. But I have to believe in human nature, and I have to believe that this man who committed so much to decency, to being a proper man, to keeping your word. You know, this is the guy who came into the military and said he wanted no drinking and no gambling. And I just have to believe that he saw that betrayal as the just from human nature, I don't care who you are, that has to feel like a betrayal of the highest order and something that is absolutely embarrassing that you don't want to write home about, literally.
Yeah, and he wasted no time in making an example out of Hickey. I think by the next day, he had him executed in front of 20,000 people. I mean, it's hard to imagine rounding up that many people for an event within 24 hours in the days before social media.
Oh, right. I mean, he literally puts the word out, says, every regiment, you're coming to this, right? So here's, I mean, again, just think of that moment, right? You're like, okay, you know about some of the plots, you know about the sedition, you know about the other things, but he hangs them and brings 10,000 troops, all the troops that he can grab at that moment, and then 10,000 onlookers come because they're like, what the hell is the fuss about? We got to see what that is. You know, it's the ultimate original flash mob without the dancing and with all the hanging, right? I mean, it's an incredible moment. Washington's pissed. I don't care what, you know, call it whatever. He is, and again, writes a letter. You read his letters that day. He's like, you know, it's like a normal day. You know, yes, hung the man, da da da. But no emotion, no, I don't care what his letters say. You're pissed. Your top man is turned sides. You're pissed.
When you were writing this book, how much time did you spend pondering what might have happened if Washington had been killed or captured? How might this one event have echoed through American history, or who's to say if there would have been any American history?
Well, that's the crazy. I mean, we try to deal with that toward the end of the book, and it's almost an unfathomable. You know, we all can play that kind of quantum leap or Back to the Future moment where, you know, Biff gets the sports book and all history changes, and those you know, you saw how history changed when Biff got the sports book.
Yeah.
You imagine if they got George Washington, right? That's not Biff in the sports book, man. It's the big man himself. And I think, you know, just right from the start, let's just say it. You know, George Washington's greatest gift to us as a culture, in my mind, and I did this in the I Am George Washington kids book that we wrote. I wrote about this even in my thrillers, but I read it all the time. It's not that he's the great general. It's not that he won the war. It's not that he, you know, was popular. It's not that he was modest. None of those, you know, his greatest achievement, as far as I'm concerned, is when we win the war, he can be the king of America. He can literally be King George. It would happily, he was so popular at that moment, he could have easily been the king here, and it would have been fine. And the most important and incredible thing he does is he doesn't take that job. He doesn't want that job. And in fact, when the painter Benjamin West is with King George in England, and King George hears, he says, what's George Washington going to do now that he won the war? And they said, oh, he's going back to his home. And I'm again paraphrasing slightly, but he says, if he does that, he'll be the greatest man in the world. if he goes back to Mount Vernon. And that's exactly what George Washington does. And he does it again when he doesn't take the presidency for that third term. What he decides to do instead is have faith in us as a country, faith in us as a people to rule ourselves, not to have this lifelong ruler, not to have someone who consolidates power like he's the emperor in Star Wars, you know, not to have in many ways what we're seeing, you know, today, but is to have someone who realizes that the best thing we can have is faith in this country. And that's his great legacy. So to me, if you take away George Washington, God knows how history changes.
Well, it's an incredible story. Before we go, I'm a fan of your show, Lost History. I just want to ask you real quickly, what's one historic relic that you'd most like to recover on the show?
Yeah, my number one was the one thing we actually really, we were able to find two items. And one of them was the 9/11 flag that the firefighters raised at Ground Zero. That one I wanted more than anything else. And I never thought it was going to happen. I thought it was gone forever. And we were able to, for those who never saw the show, I would go on TV. I would tell the story of an item, in this case, the flag from Ground Zero that the firefighters raised on 9/11 in the famous photograph. The flag went missing. I would go on TV, tell the story of the flag, where it was last seen. And I would say, America, someone out there has it. Please help us bring it back. We'll give you $10,000. And what no one knew at the time is 4 days after that first episode aired, a man walked into a fire station in Everett, Washington, in Washington State, and said, I saw the show Lost History. I want to bring this back. This is the flag from 9/11. And we spent nearly a year authenticating it, working with forensics and working with people who were testing it for dust at Ground Zero and for all these fingerprints and everything else. The former head of the FBI's Art Crimes Unit worked with us, said to me at one point, Brad, this flag is now more authenticated than most Rembrandts in museums. and that was always the object that I never thought would come back, and we did get it back. I would take any of the other items we did from, you know, even the silly fun ones like the Aston Martin, James Bond's original Aston Martin, one of them is missing, went missing from a from Boca Raton, Florida, of all places, where it was in a wing at an airport, being hidden in a storage area. But there were amazing. I mean, George Washington's teeth. I would take that one. His teeth actually went missing from the Smithsonian. They were stolen in the middle of the night.
Really?
And they're still missing to this day. The tops of the teeth were returned, or maybe the bottoms were returned. The tops are still missing. There is still a half a set of George Washington's teeth out there that are missing, which is just bananas. Why would anyone take that? And what are you going to do with that? But it's missing. And so I would take that one back just in the theme of the first conspiracy. I'd probably go with that one.
Well, again, Brad's latest book is called The First Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill George Washington. Brad Meltzer, thanks so much for talking with me.
So appreciate it.
Thanks again to Brad Meltzer for coming on the podcast. Order his thrilling new book, The First Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill George Washington, on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Keep up with Brad at bradmeltzer.com or on Twitter at @BradMeltzer. In today's age, it can be hard to sit down and learn. You may think you don't have the time to read a book. Well, think again. Blinkist is the only app that condenses thousands of nonfiction books into the best key takeaways, so you can read or listen to them in just 15 minutes. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for my audience. Go to Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/kick to start your free 7-day trial. Once more, that's Blinkist.com/kick. Flatiron School is reinventing education, starting with student outcomes. With courses in software engineering, data science, and UX/UI design, Flatiron School stands behind its students with a tuition money-back guarantee. Learn more at flatironschool.com/kickass. That's flatironschool.com/kickass. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kickass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kickass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kickass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.